Thank you very much, Dr. Johnson. Next up, Dr. Grant will be taking the podium again to talk about a very particularly challenging situation, and that is reoperative hyperparathyroidism. Dr. Grant.
Nope. Up at the top in the folder. While they're queuing that up, I don't mean to ignore first-time operations. I strongly prefer those, frankly. And if there are questions about initial explorations, I'm happy to deal with those during the question and answer period. But I did want to talk about some of the complexities about this. Interesting. That one I haven't seen before. Let's just go to the next slide. Good. This is the last time I'll show you that I really don't have any conflicts of interest. But like I say, I'll appeal during the breaks and things for those of you who want to contribute. So let's start with a case that all of these are real cases and I think can be very instructive. So this is a 35-year-old lady who was operated 2 years previously, of course, elsewhere. Maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. Found three glands at the first operation, and all of them appeared normal. The calcium this time, when you're seeing the patient 2 years later, is 10.8, the phosphorus 2.8. Parathyroid hormone level with normal range as you see it, which is pretty typical, is 45. The 24-hour urine calcium is 89 milligrams. Both the current sestamibi and ultrasound imaging are negative. So what is your advice? Should we do some more blood tests, more evaluation, even on relatives? Go ahead with the re-exploration, looking for the missing gland, do venous sampling, bone mineral density to check and see if, in fact, we've got stronger reason to do it, or should we observe the patient? Again, we don't have the means for sort of tallying everything, but let me make a case for doing more blood tests. Specifically, the key here is the 24-hour urine calcium of only 89. Somewhat subtle finding, but in my view, one of the absolute key tests in the first evaluation of the patient, and certainly in a reoperative patient, again, to look at that. Because if you have a 24-hour urine calcium that's 100 to 125 milligrams or less, then strong consideration should be for the possibility of a rare, autosomally dominant, transmitted familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia. It's also called benign FHH because these patients don't have the complications of hyperparathyroidism specifically to the bone or for kidney stones. And you can detect it partly by looking at if calcium levels are known in first-degree relatives and happen to be elevated, or somebody's had an unsuccessful operation previously, or you can test now for the calcium sensing receptor itself and determine if these patients have that. It's rare, but this is the signal to look for it. Let's do another one. 47-year-old man with active kidney stone disease, operated a year before. Three glands were identified, two were removed and called hypercellular by the pathologist, and the third was biopsied. The calcium and other levels now are as shown here. The units here are sort of an older type of assay, but let's just say if this were current 15 to 65, the level would be about 78. So clearly above normal with an elevated calcium. The sestamibi scan shows a single hot spot in the tracheosophageal groove. Pretty convincing for a parathyroid adenoma. What's your advice? Well, maybe alcohol ablate that, do a minimal access parathyroidectomy, observe it, do a standard re-exploration and remove that with possible autotransplantation, or should we be checking that urine calcium and maybe a serum protein electrophoresis to look for non-hyperparathyroid causes for the hypercalcemia? I'd make the case that at this point, I think you have enough information to re-explore. You go to where you expect to find it. You'd excise the parathyroid. And in this situation, when two parathyroids have already been removed and identified histologically, and a third has been biopsied and identified histologically, there is very significant risk that you're taking out the last parathyroid that patient has, and you may need to autotransplant. Trying to freeze that parathyroid, see if they become hypoparathyroid, and then retransplant frozen parathyroid was a really cool idea that frankly doesn't work very well. So, the most common question here, the most common cause of persistent primary hyperparathyroidism after the first operation is parathyroid cancer, a missed single adenoma, missed hyperplastic parathyroid as part of multiple gland disease, or I don't even like parathyroid surgery. I can tell you there are times when this would be for sure the answer, but it's actually a missed single adenoma. So by far, the most typical cause for reoperation is having missed the parathyroid that's abnormal at the first operation. Let's look at a couple definitions. Recurrent hyperparathyroidism does occur, but it's pretty uncommon. And it's defined as redeveloping hypercalcemia after a period of normal calcium level for 6 months. And that means you have to have that documented along the way. That can happen in patients with either MEN syndrome or non-MEN but familial hyperparathyroidism. Patients who have renal failure and you're operating, in fact, for secondary HPT, or the very uncommon sporadic primary hyperparathyroidism, that is estimated to occur only in 1 in 1,000. More typical is the persistent hyperparathyroidism where the calcium typically goes back up. Maybe their calcium comes down the day of surgery, the day after surgery, may even stay down for a few days, but most typically goes back up relatively quickly, and that is persistent disease. As I said, most typically from a single missed parathyroid adenoma. Well, let's look at a perspective comparing a first-time operation to what you're looking at for reoperation. This shows the parathyroid patients that I kept track of from 1998 to 2009, over 3,000 patients, first-time operations, 2,600 patients. And our cure with a standard operation was 96%, minimally invasive 97%, no mortality, very little morbidity, a 3 to 6 centimeter collar incision. You know, I'd say, wow, no one else, no, actually, a lot of places can do this kind of surgery and achieve that kind of success. Now we look at reoperations, and there was a dust storm up there during the last speaker. I would say that this looks pretty ominous as well. What you want to do is steer the ship this way. This is actually a picture of Hurricane Katrina as it was heading toward shore. So reoperative hyperparathyroidism can be uncertain and can be at times daunting. From the surgical perspective, the cure may drop from 96 or 97% to as low as maybe 75%. And I think we need to remember that even if we cure 90% of the hypercalcemia, if you're not careful and if you're taking out that last gland and make as many as 15% hypoparathyroid because of what happened in the first operation, the recurrent laryngeal nerve risk should be extremely low in a first time operation. It goes up anywhere from 1 to 5% in a reoperation associated with other morbidities such as infection, et cetera. The localization, I'll speak to this a little bit more, becomes really quite critical in a reoperation. First time operation, it's very convenient, it's routine, but it is not as crucial. And intra-PTH measurements, again, nice, reassuring when it's positive, but if it doesn't show that you've cured the patient, there are different implications in a reoperative setting. From the patient's perspective, they're looking at a reoperation as, well, I've been the subject of one failure, I hope it's not going to happen again. They're worried about their voice because they know about the nerve. They already have a scar. They're a little worried that, is it going to be bigger, and am I even potentially going to end up with a scar on my chest? Am I going to be permanently hypoparathyroid and have to take medication lifelong? It implies hospitalization with lost time from work, and the expense is well documented to be at least 2 to 3 times as high as a first-time operation. So there are a number of considerations, and we'll go over these. The first is to reconfirm the diagnosis, and as I said, exclude familial hypocalciuric hypercalcemia, looking at the calcium. If it's 100 to 125 or lower, you need to look at either formal calcium clearance measurements or genetic testing. Investigate for MEN or familial hyperparathyroidism. Usually, that's not a surprise. Most of the time, this can be recognized. There are a whole different set of rules when you're dealing with MEN patients. The reason I say verify the diagnosis, you say, well, wait a minute, we have endocrinologists to do that. Endocrinologists are not standing in the operating room with you when you're struggling to find that missing parathyroid. And when the patient asks, how did it work out, they're not going to look at the localization person, whether it's nuclear medicine or the ultrasound or the CT guy or the endocrinologist, and look at you and say, how did you do? So you need to be as conversant as you can with verifying the diagnosis. Review the operative notes and path slides. This has variable value. I hate to say it. They're often inadequate, confusing, and misleading. Still, we try to look at them. Look at the number that were visualized, but this is often unreliable. If they've been biopsied, which you'd say, oh, well, then that's a good thing if they've been biopsying. The problem is that if they've been biopsied, I sort of look at that as they've been destroyed. Fortunately, it's not always true, but very commonly, when parathyroids are biopsied, they're damaged irreparably. When the parathyroid has been measured, it should be measured by weight. A 1 centimeter parathyroid can be skinny and normal, whereas a 500 milligram parathyroid is almost always abnormal. And the histology, as I said in that earlier slide, when the pathologist says it looks hypercellular, and we've got pathologists who look at parathyroids all the time, and I can tell you this is in the eye of the beholder. So that is not always reliable. Again, weight is what you'd prefer. Determine if you can, if it's a missed single gland versus multiple gland disease that you're trying to deal with. They have different implications. The predictors for operative risk. When I look at somebody who has confirmed hyperparathyroidism that's persistent and I read a very thorough, complete prior operative report, I get very nervous, especially if it's done by somebody I know is competent. That just means this is going to be a hard operation because they've looked in the places they usually should. So it's a lower chance of cure. I think the risk potentially can go higher. If they have prior glands biopsied or excised, you have to then be aware of the possibility of hypoparathyroidism and the need for possible autotransplantation. You always get a cord check, if they've had a prior operation. You can argue that you should get a cord check before any neck operation. I'm not quite as adamant about that. But in a reoperation, you really need that for your own protection. And I can tell you, if one of the cords is paralyzed, especially if the adenoma is said to be on the side of the normal vocal cord, that has some pretty significant implications, and you need to have done a few of these to embark on that usually. And particularly if they've had a thyroidectomy in the process of looking for the parathyroid, because that is, at the very least, a sort of a protection when you're reoperating because the carotid is right up close to you when you're mobilizing the strap muscles if the thyroid is gone. That carries significant implications. These are the now very recent indications for surgery as judged by the NIH panel. Any symptomatic hyperparathyroidism, stones, bone disease, etc. Calcium a milligram percent above normal, stones, GFR being reduced, they have reestablished the urine calcium of over 400 as being an important indicator. Osteoporosis, age under 50, and if the patient requests. Those are for first-time operations. I would submit that they're actually pretty reasonable for reoperations, although I think you can be a little more stringent in a reoperative case, depending on what you estimate the risk to be. I just say about localization, there was a, interestingly, John Dottman at the NIH said, you know, the only localization study needed by a patient undergoing initial parathyroid surgery is to locate an experienced parathyroid surgeon. And from France, Charles Poix used to say, no objective evidence to support routine use. I say that because these two guys are fantastic and times have completely changed. Just as was alluded to in the last lecture, first-time operations, almost everybody gets localization. So even though that great quotes, it doesn't really hold true. But in reoperative parathyroid surgery, it's really crucial. If you look at an initial operation and you end up in the operating room and you found that the localization was either false positive or false negative, you're likely going to have either intraoperative parathyroid hormone level or further exploration, and you'll figure out that it was wrong. And then you continue the operation because it's a first-time operation, there's no other scarring, and you convert it. And you've got, well, maybe not as high a chance of cure, but at least theoretically a very high chance of curing the patient, even if your preoperative localization proved to be wrong. On the other hand, yeah, I'd say it's annoying, but the chance to cure is still high. In a reoperation, I think it's different. If you do the operation and you don't find the parathyroid where it's said to be, then you can decide to proceed on, but you are proceeding on in a previously operated field blindly. And the chance of cure goes down and the risk of complications goes up. So that is, in my view, a rather critical inadequacy. So you really need good localization before reoperative parathyroid surgery. Now, what do we do? Well, we still use sestamibia as our first test. We like it. It's both somewhat anatomic because most of the time it's combined with a CT scan, admittedly a sort of a second generation scan. And it's physiologic because we see one hotspot usually, but if we see more than one hotspot, we at least raise the question in our mind about multiple gland disease. We think it's the most sensitive and specific. Ultrasound is highly dependent on the quality of the person doing it. It is precise anatomy as opposed to the cestomeme, which is at times a bit of a blobogram. There are blind spots. It can't see through bone. It can't see through air. So if you have something that's deep behind the trachea in the tracheoesophageal groove, you may be missing that because you just can't see it by ultrasound. One of the values, however, is if you can see something you think is very likely parathyroid, you can use ultrasound-directed fine-needle aspiration, and we do it for PTH. And if it's parathyroid, the PTH will be very high. If it's not parathyroid, if it's a lymph node, a thyroid nodule, the PTH will at most be what the serum PTH level is or low. What has gained considerable interest, not just elsewhere, but at our institution, is the so-called 4D CT scan. It's three dimension, and the fourth dimension is time. So what you do is get a high-quality, close-cut CT scan with rapid infusion of contrast early, and it shows up on that scan. This is not moved up to here, but it is probably our second line localization now. This shows the parathyroid left superior adenoma located here. That's not hard to see and not hard to believe. Again, the subtraction scans here, but still visualized here. We do a double isotope cestomeme scan. Others use a washout technique. And you can even see it here on that scan. This is a little odd. You say, wait a minute, four glands previously identified and biopsied. This is sort of a funny location because you'd expect this superior gland to be over here behind the thyroid. So we looked a little bit more, and here it is in the carotid sheath away from the thyroid over here. So rare but real location. Here is a really odd location. The thyroid is down here. The hot spot is up high. Be aware that you can have this so-called undescended parathyroid. That's actually a superior parathyroid, an inferior parathyroid that is located up near the carotid bifurcation. When you see that, and we usually confirm that with an ultrasound, seeing that, and you can make a small incision and take it out. It comes out very nicely, but not through an incision down here. Ultrasound here is the trachea, the carotid, and an abnormal parathyroid. You can see where the normal parathyroids are on ultrasound. CT scan is valuable in the chest as well. This is a really odd and difficult place to get to. Behind the pulmonary artery, in front of the tracheal bifurcation, that takes a thoracic surgeon, as far as I'm concerned, to help take that out. You can see the fusion scan here. That's what I was talking about. You add the cestomeme scan to a CT scan, and you can pretty well define exactly where that is. The 4D CT scan you can see here, and here the very dramatic uptake of the scan with contrast. The venograms we virtually never use anymore. We rarely used to get arteriography, and now not at all. Even though this shows it nicely here, we had some significant neurologic complications with parathyroid arteriography, so we don't use that. And on uncommon occasion, we still do venous sampling, but it's the last of the tests. It's invasive, it lateralizes, but rarely truly localizes. So the best option for reoperation, don't do it, cure it the first time. Be aware of the ectopic locations that are well known and have been well known for many years. It's predicted by the embryology and almost always uncovered at the first operation. Be aware of the undescended and mediastinal, even though you won't be able to get the mediastinal parathyroids that are at least below the innominate vein. The morbidity of a reoperation is often very closely tied to what happened during the first operation, at least regarding the viability of the normal parathyroids. Identify and protect the relevant anatomy, the recurrent nerves, sympathetic chain, vagus, carotid, and innominate vessels. If you have a patient who has had a first-time operation, if you can reoperate with good localization within 1 week, that's very reasonable. If it's beyond a week, I've always waited at least 4 months to allow the surgical reaction to settle down. It's much easier and safer to operate after 4 months than it is at 2 weeks or 3 weeks. Here's a patient who has a very clear-cut, large parathyroid that you know is going to be in the tracheoesophageal groove. This is a reoperative case. It was missed the first time. That didn't work. It's a little hard to tell, but this is inferior, superior. Here's the larynx up here. This is on the thyroid, and if you look, it's sort of scarred, and you see nothing as far as parathyroid. Well, you wouldn't expect to see it there because it's behind here, and you have to be willing to get into the tracheoesophageal groove, which then you see this was the inferior thyroid vein right there. That's been transected, and now this is the inferior thyroid artery, medial to the carotid, and behind that is a large parathyroid adenoma, which then can be removed. When you first open it, you very likely are not going to see it. You have to get in the right space to find it. For the chest, you can use what I think is disappearing but not completely. Median sternotomy, the middle mediastinal parathyroid I showed you had to be removed open. But thoracoscopy has to a large degree replaced needing to go through back through the chest. And good thoracic surgeons can take out what very commonly is a parathyroid within the mediastinal thymus. As I said, cryopreserved autotransplantation has been abandoned by us and most people. It just didn't work very well. But when you think it's your last parathyroid, I tend to use intraoperative parathyroid hormone, and if it goes down to 10 or less, I will mince an autotransplant. Where you put it is up to you. I always put it in the arm if it's an abnormal parathyroid. If you're doing a thyroidectomy and it's a normal parathyroid, putting it in the sternocleidomastoid is fine. Now, just to say, here's what you should do. I like to at least back it up with the data that we have. And 374 reoperations during that time period, almost all of them done conventionally, a few chest incisions, and rare minimally invasive. I just don't feel comfortable doing a small incision when I'm trying to dissect through scar and preserve the important structures. Localization, as I said, sensitivity and positive predictive value are key indicators. Sestamibi in our hands is better than ultrasound. The median weight, 510 milligrams, the average calcium 11.2. The bigger the parathyroid, it goes to common sense, the bigger the parathyroid, the more likelihood you're going to find it by your scanning. This is what everyone wants to see, that is a pre-removal parathyroid hormone level during the operation that's high and drops down to well below 50% of the baseline at 10 or 15 minutes, depending on which one you use. Intra-PTH is helpful, it's reassuring when it's positive, but as I said, if you have these true negatives, then the problem is that you're again needing to investigate and dissect in a blind area which has been scarred and operated before. And most of the time, we want a directed operation and limit it at that. Cure rate is 92%. The complications now down to 1% with hypoparathyroidism that used to be, used to be as high as 15%. I think localization may or may not have gained us much in terms of our success in terms of curing the hypercalcemia, but I think it has helped us reduce complications, especially hypoparathyroidism. So in final analysis, the influencing factors are the risk of the reoperation, the certainty of the localization, do you need to operate or not, the patient's general health, of course, and weighing the risks versus the benefits of a reoperation in this setting. This is not going to be a lethal thing. You need to weigh those very carefully. Now, I guess I would say, though, that, you know, the treatment option might be alendronate. And she says, I tried alendronate and kind of look what happened, you know. So you can choose a medical option, I guess, but we like surgery better. Thank you very much. Oh, I might mention, yeah, that's this is Rochester the way it looks now. This is the week of summer. And again, this is our best attempt at making it look like Chicago with tall buildings. Thank you.